In 2003, Jennifer Michael Hecht wrote a book about the history of religious unbelief called Doubt.
It is my very great pleasure to introduce Jennifer Michael Hecht.
It was a bestseller. Jennifer was doing a lot of talks and book signings.
What a delight to be here. It's lovely.
And at one of them, this very nice young couple comes up to her with a question.
She's very pregnant, and they know that it's going to be a boy, and they ask if it would be okay if they have a bris, even though they're both atheists, but their families want this.
For Jennifer, this is a no-brainer.
I just said to them, you know, mazel tov, you want to have a party and celebrate your baby? There's nothing wrong with that. But I said to them as they were almost walking away, but include some poetry, maybe some Whitman.
Walt Whitman? For a bris?
Specifically, it was, I have it right here, even though I know it by heart. Yeah, it's from this incredible poem that we often call O Me, O Life, that's in Leaves of Grass.
O Me, O Life.
I mean, O Me, O Life is a pretty depressing poem.
The endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish.
In seven short lines, Whitman summarizes the tawdry, sordid awfulness of the world.
The poor results of all of the clouding and sordid crowds I see around me.
And asks himself, what's the use of living?
What good amid these? O me, O life.
And then he gives an answer that's just two lines. Answer. That you are here.
That life exists and identity.
That the powerful play goes on and you...
And you may contribute a verse.
May contribute a verse.
And that is what Jennifer Michael Hecht calls the wonder paradox.
Oh, life.
Where do you go when you want to feel small in the face of something vast and mysterious? When you want to feel your soul shiver open or fall into a state of awe or wonder? The world's religions are full of language and ceremony designed to spark those feelings, but the old sacred traditions don't speak to many of us today. Historian and poet Jennifer Michael Hecht, the author of Doubt and The End of the Soul, says there is another, even older tradition we can all access. Poetry. I have loved reading her book, The Wonder Paradox, embracing the weirdness of existence and the poetry of our lives, and I bet you would too. In the introduction to your book, there's a line I love. You say, poetry can help us make up for the loss of the supernatural.
Mm.
And I wanted to ask you about that phrase, loss of the supernatural, because it really resonated. You're suggesting that there's a kind of void many of us experience in our lives today, an emptiness, a feeling that something's missing. But what?
Yeah, I think there's an old philosophical term of a God-shaped hole in people. But I think that that's a sort of historically short-term idea, because there was poetry before there was a one God. There was poetry that made sense of life. And what I was doing with this book was really realizing that a lot of people who aren't religious, who either don't believe in God or don't believe in organized religion, are standing around at different rituals, just being there for family or friends or for the party of it, but feeling maybe a little left out. So one of the messages I'm giving people is go ahead and do the rituals from the religions that you grew up in and add a little meaning to it. By adding a poem, yeah.
I guess I was thinking...
Right, wonder and superstition, yeah.
Well...
Supernatural.
I guess I was thinking a sense of enchantment.
Yes.
A sense of wonder. Plenty has been written about the concept of the disenchantment of the modern world.
That's right.
And it seems to me that one of the big cases you're making for making poetry a bigger part of our lives is that poetry is a kind of language that can, for whatever reason, help open us up to do an experience of wonder.
That was so well said.
So why?
Yeah.
What is it about poetry that has that kind of power?
Well, I would say that a lot of art has that kind of power, but poetry, it's a condensed, small, little machine for feeling things. And the way that it works is by keeping its meanings changeable. To have a sentence that reads half on one line and half on the other line, and you can understand the first line as its own little meaning, and the second line as its own little meaning, and the sentence as its meaning. And that's in almost any poem. There is at least one of these kinds of line breaks that when you spend time with it, you notice there are a couple of messages in there.
Hmm.
And they can be paradoxical. They can contradict themselves. Whereas if we're talking about many other forms of knowledge, contradiction means wrong. Find out what went wrong.
Hmm.
There's a contradiction here. Two opposite things can't be true. But the human experience is constantly ambivalent, right? We always both want to be there at the party and to go home. We always feel love and also narcissism. We always balance emotional contradictions. Some of them we can never put into words.
Yeah. We should have an example. Is there a poem you love that you could read that you think is a good example of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. This is a tiny poem called Islands by Muriel Rukeyser. And she's speaking really to this old philosophical idea that without God sort of connecting us all, human beings are all these little separate islands, and how desperate that is. So Rukeyser's poem was published in 1976. Islands. Oh, for God's sake, they are connected underneath. They look at each other across the glittering sea. Some keep a low profile. Some are cliffs. The bathers think islands are separate, like them. It's such a wonderful poem, partially because I think it packs such a punch in those first lines. Oh, for God's sake, they're connected underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest of the poem kind of takes that apart a little bit and tries to figure out the bathers feel separate, the islands feel separate, but that we are all together.
So going back to your comment about how poetry is the one language we have really that specializes in paradox, that holds these two things together that don't seem like they would fit or that we can't make fit logically.
Yeah.
But a poem can do it somehow, I don't know, with image,
and
metaphor.
It's so crucial because we need to think in terms of straightforward logic in order to get through our day.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is we are living in such an outrageously ridiculous situation. I mean, the idea that this gray, squishy matter in the bone bowl of human skulls built the Brooklyn Bridge and the whole modern world was all invented by meat. Gray, squishy meat made everything. It's impossible. The idea of virgin birth is a lot less bizarre than consciousness. And then add to it the incredible paradoxes within that experience, how permanent we feel while knowing about death.
So I think that religions evolved and were created over time to make space for us to have those feelings.
Yes.
We often simply don't make the space. You have this concept that you talk about a cultural liturgy or a secular liturgy. Tell me more about that and how and what you mean by that.
Well, when I started this project, one of the things I was really thinking about was the way that poetry is used at weddings and funerals.
Mm.
It can be there when there's prayer or as a substitute for prayer, and it creates that moment of quiet and calm and thinking. And when you notice the prayers that they're alongside or replacing, they often mention death more than you'd think. If you, like at a wedding, why would you mention death? Well, till death do you part. Why mention that at that happy moment? Well, because what religion has done is combine tried and true rituals and some beautiful words that, yes, remind you of death, but also remind you of a flower that blooms and is never seen, to remind you of the paradox of the strangeness of beauty, but also to remember what an incredible lucky thing it was for you to get in one life at all, you know, with all the chances it took for us to be here talking to each other right now. And it's just so different when you take a moment to notice, ooh, that's a little magical.
So another example, let's say, the concept of saying grace before a meal.
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that is in so many different religions, but for those of us who are leading largely secular lives, saying grace before a meal seems a little old-fashioned, quaint.
Yeah.
So if we were going to revive that idea, is there a poem?
Yeah. I think that the first step is to think of prayers for what I call banquet prayers, because that's what they'll often call them at conferences or something. But I talk in this chapter about finding a short piece of poetry that you might want to say privately before you eat, just to slow yourself down and have a moment, not just rushing into the food or feeling.
Do you do that yourself?
There are times when I'll say an Emily Dickinson couple of lines before I eat, which does slow me down.
What's the Emily Dickinson line?
It's, a bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angles worm in half and ate the fellow raw. It goes on a little bit. It's such an odd little poem, but it puts me back into this sort of natural world moment. The rhythm of it just holds me and slows me down.
But just that look, that one little line.
Yeah.
The bird comes down, plucks a worm, and ate the fellow raw. So
yes. That
before you're eating is reconnecting you, it seems to me.
That's right. Yes.
My reading of it would be you're reconnecting to the primal experience of eating. You're remembering that everything alive must eat. You and the bird are the same. That eating often involves removing another creature's life. That
That's
there
right.
is a rawness to our lives.
All I like that. You gave me more reason to this little poem than, There's a poem, I'll read it quickly. It's by the great Mary Oliver, who we lost recently. It's called Wild Geese, and I've read this at banquet poem moments because it's just such a beauty and it brings us together. Wild geese, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.
Mm. What's that last line again? Announcing your place?
Your place in the family of things.
Oh, love that.
You know, poetry, I don't know exactly how it works, but you know, ask any poet, there's a version that comes out of us first, and you don't even know how your brain and your heart did that. And then you edit, you know. most of us yes. do have to edit even our best things. I mean, I can think of one of the poems that I love that I wrote that I always think, You want to hear that real quick?
Yeah, I'd love to.
It's called History. It's from my first book of poetry. Even Eve, the only soul in all of time to never have to wait for love, must have leaned some sleepless nights alone against the garden wall and wailed, cold, stupefied, and wild, and wished to trade in Eden to have but been a child. In fact, I gather that is why she leapt and fell from grace, that she might have a story of herself to tell in some other place.
Thank you for giving us so much to think about and so much beauty.
Thank you. This is just a beautiful conversation. I really appreciate it.
Oh, me too. Jennifer Michael Hecht is a poet and an historian, and her book is The Wonder Paradox, Embracing the Weirdness of Existence and the Poetry of Our Lives.